You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
So welcome to today's episode. Now, a lot of the episodes that we've done so far have been with the CMOs and leaders of what you might think of not very sexy brands, you know, in financial services and healthcare. And we like to say that the leaders of those brands, they do the really heavy marketing because it's not easy to market those. But today we're going to be talking to someone who's, I would say, really in the brand royalty stage. When you think about the brands that this person has led, we're going to be talking about Converse, which is obviously super topical with the Air movie that came out this year. We're going to be talking about Toms, and we're going to be talking about those magic, I don't know if we're allowed to call them boots, Ian, Uggs as well. And today he's the CMO of XL Wetsuits, living in Santa Barbara, living everyone's best life. So I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Ian Stewart today. Ian, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you very much for having me as well. Is it Gabe or Gabriel? What do you prefer?
You can pick. I've been called a lot worse.
Nice. Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
Ian, clearly not your typical American accent. Now, the first time I met someone from Boston, I thought they were Australian, but you really are Australian. How did you get from there to Santa Barbara?
You're right. I really am Australian. I've been out of Australia for 35 years and can't shake the accent. Though, as we spoke about before, it's also advantageous in the US to have an unusual accent. It certainly gets you around in interesting ways. I was, Australian, went to university, did undergrad business, thought I'd get a couple of years experience up in Asia just to get ahead of sort of some new markets and all the excitement that was Asia back in the 90s. And I haven't been home since. I've been home for Christmas occasionally, but I haven't moved back home, which is funny. I've never worked in my home country. Shot up to Asia. We'll get to this. Worked for a bunch of amazing brands in all sorts of incredible places, from China and Vietnam in the early 90s before they'd opened up, to handover of Hong Kong and the changing face of Singapore. So all around. And then got to the US 13, 14 years ago with Nike. Started in Boston, surfing New Hampshire in the freezing cold, and then got myself quickly as fast as I could to California with Deckers and UGG boots. Here I am in Santa Barbara, very settled.
So tell us about even just getting into Nike and how all of that happened and how you ended up on Converse.
Yeah, gosh. I've had a career that, part by design, part by fortune and network, I've managed to work for some incredible brands. And through that course of working at Coca-Cola, when Coca-Cola came back to Asia and China and doing a lot of really big stuff, and back then the conference circuit and you various different meetings and you meet different people and you get on radars. And as it happened, along the Coca-Cola career, MTV came to Asia for the first time, and they were building a brand new team and they were looking for people who understood the youth market. And I was the trend manager, so looking at long range consumer trends at Coke. So I was on radars for that sort of, speaking about that type of stuff. So got snapped up by MTV into the strategy team. It was an interesting journey because over 10 years, we started with one channel in Asia that was all Western music, knowing that the destination was not Western music. Then we ended up with a channel with a hodgepodge of all sorts of different countries of Asian music, which also didn't work because in Thailand you want to listen to Thai music, and in Korea you don't want to listen to Thai music, you want to listen to Korean music. So the destination over time was 13 channels, each in their local language. And then that got me on the radar and just network, and I was there for a long time. And MTV was, at that time, the 90s, if you remember, was the coolest brand. It was setting youth culture and popular culture, and that was how you discovered what was coming in through music videos. So Nike was then coming back into Asia in a full force as well. They bought Converse. They were setting up a new team. I got hit up by the Nike folks to move myself from Singapore to Shanghai, where I'd already lived before with Coke. And again, we can get into that journey. So that got me there. And then that was Converse, ran the region's marketing for a number of years, and then moved to headquarters of Converse in Boston. So that was the sort of the key jumps from brand to brand and just radar, and part by network, as I said, also part by design. I think working in your early parts of your career for great brands, be they famous, iconic brands or whatever, but just great brands with great infrastructure and foundation and training and learning and playbooks has been really great for me in the second half of my career.
Yeah. And that's going to be a lot of sort of the theme of what we're going to be talking about today, which is like the notion of having a playbook and a strategy, things that you can apply from brand to brand, whether you're working on iconic brands or not, because maybe a lot of people listening to this aren't going to be working for a brand that is iconic like the ones that you were working on. But maybe if we can start by talking about the relationship and how you see it from between culture and brand. Like, how does, talk to us about, like, in practice, the kind of culture or trend work that you can do that then influences brand and marketing decisions as a part of that playbook.
Yeah, there are positions, and I was lucky at Coke to have a job that was called the trend manager. And we were asked as a global team to look beyond the next couple of years to see if we could pick up clues for what was coming further down the pipe. In food and beverage, that would be things like changing attitudes towards health. And do people want to drink more or less sugar and more or less carbonation? And is fruit juice coming in, or tea or water or sports drinks? All the things that we were looking at, and then deciding as we report back. So I'm not deciding this, I'm just reporting back. But companies buy brands, start brands, joint venture with brands. And over my time at Coke, we did all of them, or I didn't. Again, I was the trend manager, but the company bought brands. The company created brands. We created a brand specifically for China in China for Chinese tastes that we saw over time. And we also joint ventured. So that's an example where you're going out specifically to look for something and then feed that back with a purpose to then do something with it. I think if you're looking at more fashion-oriented brands like Converse, where I worked, or UGG, or whatever, I think part of your remit as you're designing new lines is to be looking out to see how fashion trends are coming in and out. My mom gave me lots of great advice, but one of the things she said is everything's seasonal. And it was great advice. One of the things behind that is working out whether the seasonal ups and downs are within a year or over a couple of years, or some of the bigger trends can be over 10 years or whole generations or beyond. So establishing that and then deciding where you are on the curve, and then working out how long you can get away with what you're doing now versus needing to change that. I think that's fundamental to any category that's fast moving and reliant on being up to date, particularly in the youth market where it's cutthroat and it's very difficult. In a lot of fashion footwear brands, you're making products 18 months out. How are you going to know what's the color or the pattern or the trend? And there is a science behind that, but that's part of the reason you're looking out is to then design stuff.
And what was the situation when you arrived at Converse? Was it a turnaround situation, or was it building from a position of strength?
Converse was interesting that Nike bought it as a brand that was coming up to its 100th anniversary. And so many different eras of Converse. Oh my gosh, it goes back to early days of the development of the first sneakers and rubber and the East Coast of the United States. And it's a fascinating history lesson if anybody's got the time to get into it. There was times where they were making military boots. There was time they were making sports equipped footwear. They got into basketball early. They were also adopted by wrestling and weightlifting. The basketball story, which I won't get into because it's a long one, but the Converse Chuck Taylor in black was the official NBA sneaker for everybody for many years. The teams just all had the same shoe. And over time, it really didn't innovate and develop to a point where other brands came into that space. But Converse for a very long time was the shoe of choice with basketball. It then moved into different eras and different types of shoes and maybe even disappeared, certainly from popular culture. And it was just a distributor-led brand. It was just run by licensees that were making, ordering and making shoes. Nike saw something there, particularly from the sports heritage, brought a group of people in to relook at the brand. We developed strategies around youth culture through the lens of sport, but also music and art and more focused activities like skateboarding, and rode the trend of skinny jeans and rock and roll that were happening back in the middle sort of 2009 and 10 and ride some trend waves as well with that. It's a fascinating journey with Converse.
So I know that in popular culture, I know it's more of a popular culture oriented question, but with so many people who work in marketing and love brands, having seen Air, having seen that movie this year, which was all about the battle between Converse and Nike. Now, obviously, when Nike then acquired Converse, this is then a few years afterwards. But what was the market dynamic then at the time when you think about the Air Jordan and Converse? Like at that point, have they essentially decided to go separate ways in terms of go after different audiences as opposed to being head-to-head competitors?
Yeah, it's interesting because by then, and just to reset the date again, it was around 2008 and 2009 that this all happened. By then, Converse was not in performance basketball. It was the Chuck Taylor, which is obviously not a performance shoe. There was some performance shoes rattling around the marketplace, but Converse was not a dominant force in basketball. Nike could have bought Converse to make it another dominant force in basketball. That wasn't the choice that was taken. And in fact, it was interesting that many of us came into Converse, not from Nike, that they were purposefully recruiting people from other brands like Coke and MTV to inject some other ways to do it. And then were asked to come up with a strategy for the brand. And the strategy that was developed was youth culture. popular culture versus sports culture. And we rode that for 7-8 years. More recently, there's definitely, and many of us have left since then, but more recently, there was definitely some exploration by Nike around Converse's sports heritage and reviving that as a complement to Nike, which again is after my time. And then I look at Converse now and it seems to be very fashion centric, which we weren't fashion centric. We were youth culture, which was music, art, and skateboarding. So many ways to do it, many ways to play it. I think Converse, regardless of the different phases that it's gone through culturally, is always an iconic sneaker without a doubt.
Talk us through the process then of how you go from, okay, you're going to be playing in the youth culture movement then for Converse. There's so many different places that you can go, so many artists or influencers that you can partner with, so many different events. How do you go through that process of deciding what lane you're going to play in and what that strategy is going to be in order to stay focused?
Yeah, and I don't think there are definitely wrong answers, but there are many right answers. And I think what's interesting is picking some lanes, having conviction that, yes, there's other ways to do it, but this is the way that we're going to do it. And our particular lens and lane was creative culture. So the overarching idea was creative culture, creative spirits. And then the lanes and the cultural ideas that we had were specifically things like music, art, and skateboarding. And then within music, art, and skateboarding, there were specific nuances. It wasn't all music. It was a type of music. It wasn't all skateboarding. It was a type of skateboarding. It wasn't all art. It was a type of art. So picking those is one thing. I think what I've learned is sticking to it versus experimenting, changing, tweaking, modifying. I think the best strategies are those that are given a couple of years to really breathe and get going. And then you just, because you're picking up the momentum and the impressions and just trying to land that idea.
When you think about the brands that you come in, especially later on where you were in charge of the brand overall, talk about how you go about even analyzing and assessing what's the DNA of it. Like when you think about Converse against Toms versus an UGG, you talk about the idea that every brand has a very distinct DNA. How do you go about discovering and uncovering what that DNA is?
Yeah, DNA is really the fundamental thing. I think any brand and person has a DNA. So it's something that you do need to excavate and get to the bottom of. And I think that the DNA is made up of functional attributes. A sneaker is a different sort of shoe than a brown shoe or a flip-flop or a winter boot. So defining what a sneaker is, and we had a lot of fun at Converse understanding what a sneaker was emotionally and how that was different from other shoes. And then within the sneaker world, how the Converse sneaker might be seen as different from other sneakers to try and get some differentiation, like versus a Vans or versus an Addy or something like that. So you can't make it up. It is there. You've got to excavate and find it and say, asking the right questions to say, well, what makes somebody pick up a Converse Chuck Taylor? What does that say about them? What are they looking for it to say about their style emotionally and functionally, if that's relevant? And you can draw on the past if you want to. One of the things we did say at Converse was, let's honor the past, but let's not create a history lesson for the brand. I think young consumers are interested to an extent. The brand's got some heritage. Really, it's about what you're saying today. And that's the interesting part of the cultural conversation is you can bend it and change it, particularly through things like music, picking some music lanes and saying that this music is the way we're going to express this brand and we're going to go down this path. And over time, people are like, okay, this brand stands for this and not that. So you start to guide the culture as well, which I think we did. But there was an underlying idea around creativity. There was an underlying idea around, for example, the skateboarding that we were interested in was the more raw and gritty skateboarding. Nike used to say that we were the pirates to their Navy because their skateboard team were all competitive and ours were out in the back streets and alleys. So there was an attitude around it as well. I come back to the fact that once we landed on these ideas and the nuance, we stuck at it. For all the years that I was there, we had the same style of execution. We tweaked and updated as trends slightly changed and maybe the artists that we used were different or the events we lined up with were slightly different. But the ideas we were presenting stayed the same. And so many brands, either they get impatient for results and they quickly change, or the leadership wants faster results and they're forced to change, or they just see so many other ways to do it. And I think I ended up as the head of brand marketing for Converse, but for the early years, I was under a great CMO and he was right. Let's land it. Let's stick to it. Let's believe in our conviction and let's see over time how it comes to life. And it did. We grew incredibly well because of it.
I think one of the interesting things is that I think is a lesson to all marketers is if you just looked at the market size of skateboarders who wear skinny jeans and are out in the back street, and you looked at that and tried to extrapolate the sales based on even getting 100% share, that probably wouldn't have hit the revenue targets. And I think so often brands get caught in this debate saying, no, we need to expand and extend what our core audience is in order to appeal to them. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I think it's something that really stuck with me when we were talking about this last week.
I think this is another great fundamental of marketing. There's many fundamentals of marketing I think we've forgotten or lost. One of them is develop a strategy, stick to it over time, be patient, defend it, tweak the tactics. But things take time to land. They don't land in a minute or a month or a year. So I think that's a really critical one. I think defining your audiences in the layers that they exist in is absolutely critical, starting with your core user. You have to know who your core user is, your absolute most loyal archetype muse of a consumer, and both obsess them and celebrate them and use them to inspire other people. But believe that if you get your core right, they will be inspiring to people who aren't like them. And this is the thing, to your point, there may only be 100 people wearing skinny jeans, but if you believe that's inspiration at the time, they should be able to inspire tens of millions of people. You don't need to chase the tens of millions of people directly. I think that's one of the other mistakes of marketing, is you try and market to every single possible person who buys you versus saying, what's the sharp edge of the spear here? It's who's that muse? Who's the core? And believing that they're going to inspire a wider audience. And we spoke before, and I often use the analogy that the very large majority of people who buy and wear Patagonia are not scaling mountains, but Patagonia does a fantastic job in their catalog and their marketing materials of showing you mountain climbers and big wave surfers and people who are doing quite extreme outdoor activities. That's not who's the bulk of their customers. If they were to be literal, you'd see catalogs filled with people doing gardening and dropping kids to school.
And finance bros in New York.
And that's not inspiring. So I think there's a lot to be said for knowing who your core is and celebrating them and using them to inspire a wider audience. So that's your core target. You got your marketing target, who you're speaking to. You've got your commercial target, who ultimately is all the people who wear you. The core target of Converse might have been a skinny jean wearing rock and roll or skateboarder in Brooklyn. The marketing target might have been all youth who are interested in creativity. The commercial target's anybody with feet. Like the Converse, you can wear them as an infant all the way up to 100 years old. So it's understanding that.
That's a great way to think about it in terms of thinking about those three lenses. I think if there's one lesson that's most applicable to, like I said, any industry, any market, including B2B, you don't see enough of this done in a lot of B2B marketing. I love the point about it's about celebrating. Mm-hmm. The core customer.
Yeah, we'll get to where I am right now, but I'm very fortunate to be now deep inside the surf industry, and I'm a lifelong surfer. So it's great to be back into a space that I love the subject matter and really can get involved with the storytelling and also see it as a business. And the surf category is an interesting one because you've got professional athlete surfers who are your muses, the ones that you use as the beacons, and you carefully select them, if you do it right, to represent your brand's ethos and values. I'm doing this all the time. Right now, the surf industry is in flux. There's a lot of professional surfers on the open market. We could grab anybody, but we're not, because we believe our brand has a particular attitude, DNA, and style. So we want people that represent that. So we say no to 100 and choose three carefully. So that's your core, celebrating through the lens of the pro surfer, and then understanding who our absolute most loyal customers are, both because they've had us for years or that they just love us, they're advocates in the surf, and getting them into different loyalty programs and celebrating them and using them as ambassadors. So that's the consumer lens. And then from a B2B point of view, if there's 500 surf shops in the US, we're in over 100, but we have 10 that we say are our pinnacle core critically important accounts, and we celebrate those accounts. We know them, we visit them, we hang out with them, we put them into our communication materials to show that we have some loyal customers that we love. So I think that's all of that stuff is just that exists in B2C, it exists in B2B, it exists in all the different industries, is know who's your core buyer, know who your core account, obsess, celebrate, inspire.
Talk about Tom's, because Tom's is a very different situation in which he walked in, because that was really a sort of a turnaround story.
Yeah. Yeah. They've all been different stories for different reasons. Coke and MTV were introducing American Western cultural brands into Asia and doing them in a very locally appropriate and respectful way. at times where that wave of Western culture was coming in, but they were, consumer wasn't consuming those Western brands in a Western way. They wanted Coke brands, but they wanted it with the Chinese flavor. They wanted MTV Entertainment, but they wanted local artists. So that was more an adaptation learnings, particularly being an Australian living in China, marketing to the Chinese or wherever. So you're also at an arm's length, which makes you a curious marketer, but you're ultimately not selling to yourself, right? So that was all that stuff. Getting into Converse was a clean sheet of paper to do anything. It really, we could have gone in any direction. We chose the direction and we stuck at it. And I think the learning there is there's no right or wrong answers, really. There's just degrees of right and wrong, but it's about having conviction. Our boss taught us to be confident with our conviction and be patient and things will come. More recently then going to UGG and then Tom's, they were both iconic brands who were on the decline and who needed to be audited. What made this brand successful before? What's making this brand not successful now? What needs to be stripped away? What needs to be kept? What needs to be retooled or tuned? And how do we get this brand back to growth? The difference is that UGG was part of a public company, and my boss and the team around us were given a lot of latitude by the leadership to set a strategy, and were given the patience to see it over time. And we can get into the weeds on this one, but the UGG turnaround took years. And the first couple were not pretty, and we could have given up. My boss was great. She said, do you believe in this? Yes, we're going to stick at it. She's going to defend it internally, and we're going to be patient externally. And over time, it came to life, because the consistency is something that we miss in marketing as well. The impressions, the consistency, and same thing over and over again till it lands with the consumer. So UGG was a great example of proving that it takes time. Going to Tom's, this is just coming into the pandemic, and a brand that was being handed over from one owner to the other and losing the founder at the same time and going to the hands of new private equity who, and the reason I bring that up versus a public company is that they have less, their timelines are way shorter. Their observation was, you did this at UGG, it took 3 years. We want you to do it here. We want you to do it way shorter. And of course, I wanted the project. So I'm like, that sounds great. I can do that. Then you get inside and then you say, look, the reality is these things take time. It takes time to reset a table. Back to impressions. We know it's changing because we're living it every day as a job, but the consumer doesn't think about this brand all the time. So they need, back to classic marketing theory, at least 10 impressions of your new message, hammer it to them all the time to A, show that this is what you mean. You're not going to keep changing it, but B, so it sinks in. So saying to the new owners, it's going to take time. It's going to take a couple of years. And then, of course, the pandemic hits and everything's out the window. And we're also resetting all sorts of other strategies. But it took time.
There's a great – I just want to draw parentheses here, Ian, just because there's a little career and career lesson that you popped in there that I wanted to call out, which is this notion of, even though when you were in the interview process, you knew that what they maybe were asking for wasn't achievable. You're like, okay, I'm going to go with it to get the role and then to go and influence it. Because I could imagine a lot of people, probably myself included, that might have said at the interview, no, sorry, that's not going to, if you want me to come, it's going to take longer than 4 years and you need to change your outlook and horizon.
Yeah. It was somewhere in the middle. I didn't say, yep, we're going to do it in 6 months. But I didn't say, I'm only taking the job if you've got 4 years to wait. Because I also saw from the outside some differences. UGG was somewhat the same in terms of terminal DNA. It wasn't being the brand that it could be. And
DNA.
Yeah, it was just
what
like
do you mean by that?
It had lost anything that it had stood for, not through anyone's fault, just that the brand hadn't been nurtured over the previous couple of years. So anything that the brand may have stood for in terms of beautiful products and materials and fashionability and iconic status in footwear had just not been polished, and it was just tarnished, and it needed a shine. So the DNA was just, it just wasn't living up to its DNA.
Was that because of the marketing, that because of actual product decisions, or a combination of both?
And trends. I think that particularly in footwear and fashion, trends come and trends go, and brands can often ride great waves to greatness and believe that's going to happen, go on forever. And I think if you don't, particularly in footwear and fashion, iterate your product line to keep up with fashion versus saying, no, this is who we are, this is what we make, and you're all going to buy it forever. There are not that many footwear fashion brands, maybe LL Bean pajamas, we all keep buying them or whatever. But
I was going to say Crocs is a great example right now for me that sort of fits in that world where, you know, initially, if you just looked at it, and you didn't know what the brand was, similar to an UGG boot, you might say, how on earth is that going to be able to be more than a fad or sustain itself.
We've studied that brand for a very long time, so I'm very happy to come back to it because I think Crocs fed the bonfire with so much celebrity and so much collaboration to get so much instant like spotlight and heat and sizzle and almost like the holy crap, here comes another one. Just massive adoption so fast. It adopted quickly. It was already adopted by a lot of the influencers before all of that happened, but it got adopted by the mass so quickly. They accelerated the trend curve incredibly fast because they just went every week another collab. And some of them were amazing and some of them were shocking. But in general, their spotlight remained on them constantly to mass adoption. No brand can survive mass adoption when the original influencers and opinion leaders who discovered that brand have run for the hills because now every mainstream person is wearing them. We can talk about brands like Birkenstock that kind of can be quite timeless because they don't make too much noise. They're just always there. But Crocs is the opposite. They were very noisy and now everybody's wearing them. And if you believe that trends come and go because the influencers move to the next thing, skinny jeans, wide jeans, short jeans, long jeans, and they've moved on from Crocs. You have to believe Crocs' lifespan is shorter than not. I don't think it's iconic because it doesn't look classic. It doesn't wear classic. It doesn't speak classic heritage. Like it's not constructed in a beautiful way or an interesting way for longevity. And it's not that environmental, to be honest. So I see it's a great case study for the opposite reason, which is how fast can you grow by spending all your marketing money on celebrity? But then be damned because I don't think it can be sustained. So whereas UGG, I think there was some stuff behind UGG over 40, 50 years of a beautiful brand, which I know being Australian, very well aware of how UGGs were originally conceived. Underneath it, it's a luxurious product. Sheepskin is very warm and it's very moisture wicking and it's very comfortable and luxurious to wear. So the basic ingredients of the brand were there to be rebuilt, which we did. We rebuilt the luxury feel of sheepskin away from the classic UGG boot that maybe had lost its shine into new product iterations, everything from spring summer sandals to apparel. So we repolished the DNA in a contemporary way.
One of the classic marketing challenges, brand challenges that you had to deal with at Tom's was this, that you see everywhere, is this notion that you had an aging consumer profile, right? So you had to dilemma of, do you double down on the core or how do you appeal to a new while sustaining your core?
Yep. Which starts with a really important question, which is, what are we doing to nurture and celebrate that core lady who's been with us for 15 years, who buys a lot of shoes? She's very loyal. She's probably very influential in her group, wherever that may be in the United States. And she's valuable. Her lifetime value is high. So you don't want to walk away from that. That would be a bad decision. You also don't want to age out with that person by only sticking to that consumer as they get older and older. And 50 years later, they may be no longer. So you have to rejuvenate your brand. And I think that's where it becomes complicated in marketing is, how do you appeal to a aging core loyal person and rejuvenate to a younger demographic that, because again, in footwear and fashion, everybody wants to be youthful and fashion forward. And that tends to therefore be the younger consumer. The most fashion brands epicenter is younger, not older. So how do you do that? That was part of the challenge of Tom. So you add in aging core customer without any rejuvenation over many years, a footwear silhouette that it was so out of style that it hadn't really kept up any contemporary trends around chunky sneakers and big soles and all the bigness of shoes that were happening in 2019 and 2020. That was the opposite of that. It was out of trend. So there's another layer of complexity. And then Tom's was famous for inventing giving, B2C brand, consumer brand, extremely generous giving with buy one, give one. And that was the model that Blake Makowski invented. His idea was, if you buy a Tom shoe, we'll give one to somebody who needs a shoe in another part of the world, but like revolutionary. But that giving model maybe had evolved into new ways to give. So we had the opportunity to assess that giving model and decide if that was the best way to move forward. We were a new team, new owners, new team. The founder was out. We're able to do anything. The easy thing would be to keep doing what we were doing, just modernize the shoe, keep selling to the core, she'll age, and do minimal changes and make minimal impact. That wouldn't have set the brand up for long-term success. So we overhauled the targeting to go younger. We put some pieces into place to celebrate the core customer who already existed, major overhaul of the product portfolio to make it modern and relevant. And the hardest thing we did was to change the giving model, which was to update that from giving one-for-one shoes to people in other parts of the world that didn't have shoes to, for a number of reasons, changing the giving model to giving a third of profits. So a more transparent way of saying the more we make, the more we give. Secondly, giving those profits to domestic charities. So remember, this is the pandemic and all of the issues, the social issues that came about in the United States in 2021, 22. And one of the big issues that came to the forefront was mental health and just equality and equity and being fair. So we shifted to giving profits transparently to domestic charity nonprofits in spaces like mental health. Massive redirection could have been, as we said internally as we launched it, the worst thing we've ever done or the best thing we've ever done. It was within the zeitgeist of the culture, really well-timed to be able to say, we're doing this because the world has changed. Pandemic, social injustice, the need for better equity. We're changing everything, and the shoe, and the targeting, and the communication, and the marketing materials. It was a complete overhaul of the brand. It was a different brand. And that is a very difficult exercise. And the owners, back to the interview sort of question, said they wanted all that done as fast as possible. We did all of that in 6 months in a public company without a pandemic and any pressure from new owners. You might have spent years tuning all that up, like a brand refresh and a product portfolio refresh and a giving model refresh and a targeting refresh and retail refresh. But we did it all in 6 months. And then I brought out back to my interview point. Now we've done everything on an escalated timeline because we came with playbooks. We know how to do things faster because we've done this sort of stuff before. Now that we launch it into the consumer space, it's going to take time. You can't then, doesn't matter how amazing you make it, unless you do a Crocs. And that's why we talked about Crocs, because the owners were like, let's do a Crocs. And we said, sure, we can do a collaboration launch every week with a celebrity like Justin Bieber every week. If you open the checkbook, it costs money. But with what we have, it's going to take a couple of years to land this new brand.
That's fascinating. One of the things that we talked about as well, and this notion of being able to appeal to different audiences, can you talk a bit about, we were talking about Nike and how Nike have a singular brand, yet the way they execute across tennis or how they execute across golf or basketball, maybe as a bigger point of contrast, is very different. Yet everything still adds up to a single Nike brand. But take us sort of behind the scenes, because oftentimes when we talk about brand, it's no joke. The corporate brand team is managing a corporate brand and they want it to be consistent, yet you want it to be able to flex to different audience market. What's the secret behind how Nike does that successfully?
It's way more micro marketing than master brand or global brand or parent brand marketing. I think that they could go Nike as an idea for anybody. And they do have some language around everyone's an athlete and you know, obviously Just Do It is ubiquitous to everything that they do. And everything they make is high quality performance, you know, sports related wear. So that's the master idea. And I suppose you could just market to that at a macro level and just continually talk about it as a large concept. But I think what Nike does really well is they take that idea and then they market it into micro communities. So they execute that idea within the tennis community in a different way than they execute that idea into the golf community or the skateboard community or the basketball or the football. If you're a fan of all those sports, you might touch the brand in different ways because you turn up to a golf event and see Nike executed this way with these athletes in this marketing style. Then you go to a skateboard event and you'll see Nike executed differently. But by and large, I think most people would see the micro execution in isolation, say, this is the Nike I love because I love golf, and this is the Nike I love because I love basketball. I think it's really clever. I think that they've done a great job of thinking at the most grassroots level. And I think that a lot of what we did at Converse by saying our master idea is creativity, the communities we're going to unleash that to music, art, and skateboarding, there is going to be some crossover because we believe that cultures do collide and you can have interesting collisions of music and skate and art and music, et cetera. But by and large, having really pure executions into those different communities means that your brand looks like it's been built for that community, right? That's the ultimate test of success. Wow, this is a skateboard brand. And then someone else is over around the corner going, wow, this is a great art brand. This brand really understands music. I think that's successful.
I love your plane. Talk about your plane analogy as well.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, that airlines are also the masters at their craft of targeted marketing, because you think about the way that British Airways or Qantas or Singapore Airlines markets their first class to the first class consumer who is spending a lot of money to be in that Singapore up the front of the plane experience versus the business class experience, which might focus more on legroom and meals. And then the economy, which might be a little bit of legroom, a lot of entertainment to take your mind off it, and probably not the meals. And then there might be even a budget offering for the cheaper seats. It's the same airline. It's the same brand. It's Singapore Airlines. And their master idea might be around the best service regardless, but the execution of that idea into economy, business class, first class is clearly handcrafted into that consumer, and they all get on the plane and it's all the same trip to the other end, but they've all had a different brand experience.
Having worked across all these brands over many years and managed a lot of different teams, what's been key to you in terms of building great teams?
Yeah, I guess I could get into what sounds like cliches, but I think that, first of all, I believe that we're all adults and we don't need to be micromanaged. I think that we all can work it out, and we are all hopefully mature enough to, if we can't work it out, we'll go and find the solution, either by going to your manager or going to Google, how do I do this? Or going to a mentor or going to a friend or whatever. So I believe bringing the best out of people is by leaving them alone, letting them work it out. I thrive best in that environment where I'm happy to just get on with it and I'll go and find help when I need to. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing, which funny enough is something I did learn specifically at Nike, is respecting people's lanes. It's very easy to have an opinion over every other department because it all seems like, I'm sure the finance team would love to know a different way of doing reporting, or let me just check in on the logistics team and see if I can give them some tips. But I don't do that because logistics and finance tend to be a little bit more specialty skills. But you and I both know in marketing that everybody thinks they can do marketing. So you need to defend your marketing turf, particularly because everybody's got an idea on, why don't you make it black? Or I think it would look better if the creative looked this way, or have you thought about that? So I think that respecting lanes makes a better team.
To me, the actual question there is, can you give us some examples of how you've done that? What sort of rebuttal or defense have you given? Because if there's one story that you hear that is most common, is what you just said, everyone having an opinion on marketing. So what have been your most successful strategies, and also any that maybe didn't work when it comes to getting people to stay away from that lane?
I think that you can start getting into somebody's business and see, and when they get a little bit upset, you could certainly have a quiet conversation around, as you can see, nobody really likes other departments getting involved in your business. And I think that's a little bit passive aggressive and hostile. I think you can have a quiet word with someone to say, listen, I know it feels like we're looking for extra opinions and points of view, but we're actually not. I think that I've got a job to do and I hopefully know how to do it. And you've got a job to do. Hopefully you know how to do it. I often use what got spoken about quite a lot at Nike, which is, it's like bowling. If we all bowl in our own lanes, we're all going to have a great time. If the minute I start throwing balls into your lane and you start throwing it into mine, it all goes sideways quickly. So I think if we all bowl in our own lane, it's all for the better. Yeah, it's a problem particular to marketing because everyone thinks it's easy. Everyone thinks it's just about picking colors and talent and somehow producing an ad that works. It's obviously way more scientific and complicated than that. So I think keeping your lanes is a big one. I think as you get more advanced in your marketing career, critical to more consciously develop a playbook. We've all got playbooks. Over years, you tend to do the same things multiple times. And if you're aware of that, you can start to work out what works and what doesn't. But I found in the last 10 years of my career, of my 30 plus years, is actually having a, what am I going to do? What's my playbook? So coming into a new brand and saying in my first 30, 60, 90 days, or even more aggressively coming into Tom's, is, here are the 100 questions I need to have answered in the first week, because I'm going to tackle all these things with the playbook. And more recently in my current role, just coming straight in swinging, like knowing exactly how to A, audit the situation, B, know how to get rectify things and get things going as fast as possible.
Is it actually written down? Is it printed out? Is it just in your head? Give a sense of what you talk about playbook, what that actually is. Is it 400 pages? Is it 20 pages?
Funny enough, I did write it out. I was doing a project for some friends who have an incubator, Rob Diederick from MTV and his partner, Brian Atlas. And they had me come in on a project last year to do an audit of one of their acquisitions. And so I had to write it down. And so, yes, it is now written down. It starts at a very macro level, asking questions around, is the brand articulated? Like, what would the DNA be? And what's the functional benefits and emotional benefits of this brand? And what the brand's purpose be? And who might the core and secondary and tertiary consumers might be, and what's the total size of the commercial opportunity? So all those fundamentals, just map it out. Who's your key competitive set? What's your number one competitor you want to get share from? Some of those questions, you'd be surprised people. I love this one. Which one competitor are you trying to beat? When it's Nike, it's Adi, and when it's Coke, it's Pepsi. And you often learn those things in those types of brands, but many people don't think. Obviously, we're all trying to grow the market, but who, if you could take share from, are you? Many people can't answer that. So asking those types of questions. So just laying the framework of, how's the brand operating? What's its hero product? How does it go to market? What's the seasonal calendar look like? That's all framework stuff. And then I've got a whole series of pages around KPIs, particularly in the digital and the e-commerce space, e-com percentage of business, what's the average traffic, the lifetime value, the conversion rate, the AOV, when was it at its highest, where is it now, how's it trending, what are we doing to increase conversion rate and AOV and increase qualified traffic. So this, you get into some pretty nitty gritty in the weeds stuff, but that's where the money's made. All that other stuff is just to get an understanding of how formed the strategy and execution of the brand is. When you're getting into the weeds of e-com, for example, or key accounts for wholesale and all of those different things, that then you're starting to make money.
When you think about having worked at some of these brands that are, always, that are so trend focused, what's the importance of having leading indicators or lagging indicators as part of that, right? Because sometimes by the time you get those KPIs, it's too late.
I think now in digital, all KPIs don't lag at all. I think it's the opposite problem in the digital space, which is you can get overwhelmed with measuring your conversion rate every hour, or have your owners measure it every hour when you're only measuring it twice a day and having to catch up because people are like, oh, it's gone down by 0.2%. I think that's then getting into a measured situation of having targets. And that's part of the playbook as well, is you don't need to chase forever. You need to say a conversion rate in our category, industry or category should be 3. It's currently at 2.5. Anything over 3 is successful. So let's get it there. How do you get it up 0.5 percentage point? And then having a specific tactic and model around that. That's just really good business to make money and maximize and optimize. The other KPIs at a softer end, using examples like UGG and Tom's, is how do you reverse negatives? How do you get more people to say this is a brand that suits my style? How do you maybe don't always need to raise awareness, but certainly raise a positive attitude towards the brand? So you need to be tracking those things over time to see if your bigger idea, the bigger strategy that you've got formed, is landing or not.
Yeah, I find that sometimes, because we talk about the purchase funnel and we talk about the notion of a consideration middle of funnel, but it was really interesting hearing you say a brand that suits my style. That a lot of thought and strategy probably goes into the specific wording of what that question is to elicit the right response that gives you a sense of, that gives you that leading indicator, that predictive or leading indicator to see if we're heading in the right direction.
30 years of doing market research and looking at attitude statement questionnaires that have got 30 or 40 attitude statements, and do you agree, disagree, or 5-point scales, or, and then all the conjoint analysis and clustering and segments and all that sort of stuff. The one thing that popped out every single time in every single study forever in my experience is a brand that suits my style. How many people say yes? How many people say no? If you can just focus on that and track that one, particularly in a lot of the spaces where style is important. So it may be less important if you're selling refrigerators, but it's certainly very important if you're selling cultural products and fashion and footwear. You don't wear things that don't suit your style, and you don't gravitate towards things that you don't think suits your style. So it's a really perfect intersection of articulating who you think you are and who you think the brand is.
Even if you're buying a fridge, or even if it's a B2B, but there's probably some equivalent that.
Yeah,
because it feels like we're so obsessed with the NPS metric at the moment.
You're absolutely right. I should rephrase that. It's applicable in every category. You might think that it's most applicable because the word style is in the statement, that it most suits fashion products, which it does. But you're absolutely right, because it's a post-rationalizing statement as well. If you've bought the GE series of kitchen appliances, you want to believe that you've done that because it suits your style versus LG, right? Or Samsung. So it validates. Or if you're in the purchase cycle and you say that Toyota suits my style, as you're going towards buying a car, you're trying to match yourself up with that brand. Who do I think I am? Who do I think they are? This brand intersects with that conversation. This brand suits my style. Again, I've seen forever that this is the most needle moving statement. It's also the most closely related to market share potential.
Like, I even wonder in B2B if a version of that question in B2B would be a brand that fits with my company.
About consultancies and banks, I think that if a consultancy or a bank had a higher result for a brand that suits my style than their market share, then they probably have a lot of opportunity to grow. Because say, for example, McKinsey has a 65% brand that suits my style, but 5% market share. A lot of people want to work with that company, but for whatever reason. So understanding why there's the delta. I think that if a brand had a 5%, a brand that suits my style, and a 50% market share, they could probably be looking towards a decline. And that might be one of those icons who've lost their way.
That's fascinating. Ian, you're one of those rare people who they have followed their passion from a work standpoint. Now, there are different schools of thought that oftentimes you hear, actually, it's better to not mix your work and your passion area, because then it becomes work. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I've always worked for great brands. So if that's part of what excites me, that I've succeeded so far in all my career. I've worked in categories where I may be less personally excited about the product. Toms is a women's shoe and UGG is primarily a women's footwear brand. And I don't wear women's footwear. So it's not as close to my personal passions, but I'm passionate about brands and culture and storytelling as a big idea. And I'm also really excited about moving the dial with the numbers and the metrics down the bottom, and especially in the digital space. So it's all been fantastic. MTV was awesome to work at. Music, why not? Converse, youth culture, why not? Now I found myself in a situation where I've joined a small private equity fund to buy surf and snow brands to build a portfolio where we can start to make the portfolio really profitable by having an integrated back office, so all shared services, which takes out for small brands the need to worry about finance and HR and legal departments. And we've got two warehouses and logistics are all shared, and front end sales forces are shared as well. And the marketing playbook is taken from one brand to the other. So that for me is, as a business concept, is the culmination of all my career. You could call that any category and I'd be excited, because we're taking all those ideas into a business framework called portfolio. How do you make it profitable? How do you use playbooks? How do you use learning? How do you get synergy? But I have the added benefit with the other folks that I'm doing it with, is that we're all passionate surfers or skiers who live in places like Santa Barbara or Aspen. So we're also getting to live categories that we love, which makes acquisition surprisingly easy, because you can, if that's all you've done all your life, it's very hard to fake it with us if you're a surf brand or a snow brand.
Yeah, so. Yeah, don't rub it in, Santa Barbara and Aspen. What's like the most interesting thing about the surfing category or the industry right now that most people don't know about?
Half the category has or is in the process of being sold to licensing companies. There's a massive changing of the guard. People are all up in arms saying, oh my gosh, we've just lost the whole four biggest brands in surfing to licensing companies on the East Coast. And then the bottom of the categories are all, sadly, some of them are running out of money because of post-pandemic, over-inventory, lack of consumer demand, just running out of cash. So there's some big upheavals in the category. But what's interesting, over the 5 or 6 decade arc of surfing, this happens all the time. This comes back to my mom. Everything's seasonal. If you haven't watched or if you have watched the Patagonia movie about Jerry Lopez, a great surfer of the 70s and the 80s, that was an era with brands like Hang Ten, which people... And Lightning Bolt and whatnot, that people thought this is it. Those brands aren't around anymore, because those brands went up and then they went down and got replaced by other brands that went up and went down. And then again, now brands have gone up and are going down. So we, as a middle-sized funded iconic brand that's keeping very focused and simple with our playbook, are growing phenomenally, because we're capturing from the top and we're capturing from the bottom. So there's a big upheaval that we're going through.
Ian, I have to ask you, because you mentioned it twice now, you've got to give us some context around your mum's quote around everything is seasonal. Was she a master CMO where did that come from?
Sports doctor. I think it was just one of those things that she always used to say. I think it was from a motherly point of view, was there's good times and there's bad times. Everything has its season. But I think also it might have been a reference to what goes up goes down. It might have been a reference to everything has its moment in time in the sun. I think it was just a general statement that I've used.
It's a lot deeper. It's a lot deeper. There's a lot more wisdom.
Yeah, no, there's a lot there. I think it is the whole what goes up comes down, if you believe that. But what goes up can come down over hundreds of years or tens of years or months, or constantly come back to that. Because now whenever I look at something, I say, where is the thing on the arc? Like, where are we on the social justice arc? Where are we on the political arc? Where are we on the fashion arc? Where are we on mental health arc? Where are we on climate change? Like, everything is on an arc. And I learned this early on at Coke. The arcs are small and long. So that would be a big takeaway, is just constantly thinking about everything you're looking at. Are we rising? Are we peaking? Are we declining? Can we stretch that, change that decline, change its course? Can we slow it down? That's been a big takeaway from all of my career, is like, where are brands on the journey, the up and the down?
How do you stay fresh and updated to ensure that playbook is all, whether it's related to the playbook or not, but that you stay fresh and up to date with everything?
Very curious. I'm looking and studying and interested in watching everything around me, brands and my friends and other brands, and talking to lots of people in other brands and how are they doing things and what are they seeing, and reading the trade press and watching, you know, new things coming in and old things going out. So I'm always looking for all of that, the constant change and flux, and also trying to be simple and focused down the middle. I think that, again, I think we've spoken about this, having a simple, clear strategy and sticking to it means you ride through what is inevitably going to be a lot of chaos and flux and change.
And maybe as a final question, what's your sort of biggest advice to, if a young person comes and asks you advice, they're entering into career in business or marketing, what's the sort of the main thing that you tell them?
Yeah, I have a 24-year-old son who's 2 years into his career, having gone to great undergrad business school. But I've said to him, for the early days, is put in the hard work and do the learning. And it's not easy in the beginning. It can be easy if you don't try hard. It will be beneficial to your career if you work hard at the beginning and like really get a great boss and mentor and manager and work the long hours and learn the ropes. But work for great companies. And I say this to so many people, like work for great companies. If you have a choice, great companies doesn't have to be famous companies. It's just great companies that are successful and big, because that means they've got systems and maybe they've been around for a long time. So they've got the playbook and the learning. Cut your teeth in those ones and go to smaller ones and apply that learning later on down the track. I say, which is interesting, is be mobile, particularly in that first 10 years of your career. I've lived in 11 countries and not always were offered the chance to move that I said, I'm stoked about that. There were some moves I did that I didn't want to do, but the opportunity was to not. And I'm thankful for all of the moves I made, because one door opens 10 more. And I think if you stay stagnant and don't move, particularly early in your career, then I think you're going to miss out. That doesn't mean just moving to another town or moving to another state, moving to another country, if you've got the energy and the opportunity to do so. But that moving around, I think, makes you such a great marketer, because you just see it from so many different perspectives. And then the big brands and the small brands and the regional roles and the global roles. And maybe sometimes you're more focused on the wholesale channel and sometimes you're focused on the e-com. Like having all those perspectives ultimately down the other end of your career gives you that rounded experience.
Been absolutely delightful to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Brilliant conversation.
Awesome. Good stuff.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.